Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. It is our pleasure. I'm joined by co-host Carolyn Betts, General Counsel of Soleri. It is our pleasure to welcome a friend and ally, David Webb, from originally Cleveland, Ohio. Carolyn is in Ohio, but now in Sweden. It's wintertime and it's snowing. And David joins us because his new book, The Great Taking, describes his journey and concern about the integrity of the global financial system, something you've heard a lot about at the Soleri Report. So, David, thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report, and congratulations on the success of The Great Taking.
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks for having me. And it's nice to see you. And we've done a lot of stuff together.
Yes, we have. So I first heard your presentation, a brief summary, in Switzerland in 2020, and you described your journey of going from being a very successful hedge fund manager to simply trying to find a place in the world where you could park your assets and be confident that you owned them and they were safe at the custodian. And this was an issue that I had been looking into and was concerned about as an investment advisor. So I took a great interest. But before we go into your analysis, can we start with your history of basically, I'll summarize it, realizing that there were serious problems during the financial crisis, and then going and at least looking for a personal solution for trying to ensure that your assets were safe?
Yeah. Well, I would say that my awareness of things really profoundly shifted even earlier after the Right. financial crisis, because I was handling all the trading in a very detailed way. And so I had a kind of, I could see that something had changed in the way the market was behaving after, in the aftermath of the Asian financial crisis. So there was something hidden that wasn't really apparent in terms of these odd movements in the market. And that's when I started to look at the scale of central bank money creation. And I realized that the scale of money being created was an order of magnitude any bigger than economic growth. So the implications of that are enormous, because it means you're not getting transmission into the real economy. Something else is happening. So I started becoming very concerned, really literally, for the world. It wasn't just
Well, I think all along you've been really worried about the world.
So. So that was when I it was as serious as a heart attack even then, trying to understand what was happening with these money flows. It led to an understanding of how the transmission was working and a kind of lag effect that I could use to get positioned ahead of moves up and down in the market. And it was the kind of thing that I would explain to people what I saw and why I was doing it, and literally no one wanted to hear about it. Even if I explained it to them, they weren't going to use it, because that was conspiracy theory at that time. So let's see. Then,
so let me just ask you a question. Did you feel that the pricing system was becoming more and more divorced from reality because of central banking intervention? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. And you know, it's I've thought more about what is really happening when you enter this phase of the change in the transmission into the economy. The way I explain it to people is, imagine we had a finite amount of money. So for you to get money, someone would have to give it to you. And Then someone comes up with a way to create money out of nothing. That is magic to begin with, because it allows projects to happen that would not happen otherwise. And it has a very high turnover, because when that created money is spent, you see, if in a finite system, you would have to sell a product or service, which puts downward, you're then competing and it puts downward pressure on price levels. If it's created out of nowhere, puts an upward pressure on everything. So it's an extraordinary power. It has a very high velocity as that created money is turned and spent by multiple people over the course of a year. So when I did a money and banking course when I was young, the textbook said that velocity was maybe 6 or 7 times. That's what people thought at that point. So if you, what I realized what was occurring was that this money that the central banks were creating, with it being many multiples of any economic growth, it meant that this velocity had flipped, inverted, as I would say, where the money creation was now much higher than any economic growth. Right. So what happens then? It seems to me that the money goes into things that are actually hurting the real economy, right, not helping the economy, hurting the real economy, and going into warfare, which is what we've seen. The same thing was happening going into the 20th century. So it seems to go into a different geopolitical macro kind of environment when the transmission is no longer working for the real economy, that it's time to hurt people and break things.
Right. So you used to see this in Washington, where the federal budget would be, the money would be spent not in a way that would optimize the economy of the sector that it went into. It was spent in a way that achieved a variety of control goals and strategic goals that were highly uneconomic.
Yes, but it's about control.
Right. And you could finance it because the central banks could print money and the government could basically hide the disclosure of where it was going and what it was doing.
Yes. Not only is it it's not benevolent, it is malevolent, and it right. has unlimited money behind it.
Right. Right.
But you also have a huge percentage of the money going into financial instruments rather than manufacturing something.
Yes, and the financialization. And then eventually, I didn't really understand this early on, but I'd say it's a more recent thing I've come to believe, is that the financialization is an integral part of the strategy, blowing right. things out financially and of course the same phenomena was observed in the early 20th century. That's what causes the bubble, and the collapse are integral to the taking and suppression.
Right. And so one of the things that'll come up later, but I'll bring it up now. One of the most extraordinary sources of stolen money is collateral fraud, in many different markets in many different ways. And you get into that issue in your book. But to keep the collateral fraud going, you have to do many different extraordinary things. But the collateral fraud has been a source of explosive wealth over the last 5 decades.
I think it's an age-old thing.
Yeah. But but if you look at the technology that they've come up with, what digital technology and derivatives and all these other things and the financialization has done is it has taken it to a whole
yes.
extraordinary level.
Yes. I mean, the taking of things through foreclosure and taking things as security, that was very effective in the Depression. Go through that strategy. But they've been working on this. Because now mm-hmm. we have this innovation that they can take things that are not even encumbered with debt that people right. have used as collateral themselves. And, you know, I'm responding to what you're saying about the innovation. The key thing here is that securities for 400 years had been personal property. So you could hold them outright and have clear title. And if your custodian failed, you would just say, I'm sorry that happened. Here's where you can deliver my securities. So
tell us, jump in and tell us how you got to Sweden.
Well, okay. This relates to that. I was expecting, because I studied the securitization process and how the moorings had been slipped on that, and I understood the scale of what was coming in terms of insolvency, I reached the conclusion that it was a fool's errand to try to run a hedge fund through that collapse, because the prime brokers would all fail. And they did, in fact, fail. So I was, you know, nothing fancy. I was in things like laddered CDs at many, many banks, and I was in government bonds, different, you know, kind of intermediate term government bonds, laddered. And I had used Swedish government bonds, and I, you know, went through that, the great financial crisis completely unperturbed. I was totally fine. But I saw this Barron's article in 2008, early 2008, about this broker dealer that had failed. No one was paying much attention to this, but I could see that the securities, the client securities, had been swept to the receiver. And at that point, my head exploded. I was no longer unperturbed. I needed to figure out how could that possibly have happened. So again, it was something that no one cared about. I couldn't really talk to anybody about it, but I going into it to begin with, I could see it had something to do with the changes to the Uniform Commercial Code. This really wasn't hidden. You could find it. So I started to realize that this subversion had happened in the U.S., and that there really was no way to hide from it within the U.S. system. So I was doing things like I was thinking about going to New Zealand. You know, we had a place in Canada, but Canada was part of this. So I finally got on a plane to Sweden in March of 2009, which was kind of the scary turning point of the whole thing. That's when March was when Bernanke gave a talk in front of the Council for Foreign Relations saying that we will basically suspend mark-to-market accounting for the banks. And that's when things turned, you know. But so I came to Sweden, and I found I do this kind of thing. I just get on a plane, go right into it. And I found that I could not open a bank account. They said, well, you, without a personal number, you can't open a bank account. So I went back to my little room and thought about it. And I went back the next day to Handelsbanken, and I said, I am buying an apartment. I think I need an account here if I'm buying an apartment. And so they thought about that for 2 days. And then came back and said, well, I think we can open an account for you. And that's how it started. And I did buy an apartment, so I could do that. And I found on that first visit, this was what I was very interested in. Could I open a securities account where I could hold the bonds directly and was able to transfer all my bonds from the U.S. to Handelsbanken? And they were, so Sweden still had, it was an electronic book entry system. Materialization itself is not the problem, because obviously you can know who owns what. You know, right. So you had an account showing your bonds with specific numbering of what your bonds were. So that was a big part of why I came. That was really it. And right. But I called my wife while I was here and I said, you know, I think you'd like it here. And of course, it's lovely.
Yeah.
We do like it a lot, and we would miss it if we ever had to leave.
Anyway, so but as time went by, you got nervous about all custodial relations, including Sweden, right?
Well, Sweden. I then followed. You know, I worked to keep Sweden from being subverted, really, very seriously. Sweden and Europe. Because I realized, okay, I'm here now. It became my mission to work at that. So, you know, what did I do? I found people, especially in the finance world, you kind of have to get involved to figure things out. So you have to start doing things to figure things out. So I would go out and meet with people and they would ask me, well, why have you come? And I would tell them and they would say, well, people need to know about this. You need to talk about this. So I really didn't want to do it, but I started speaking about it. And then I was through friends. A meeting was arranged for me to speak with the Minister for Financial Markets and his state secretary. And I remember it was a very moving thing to me because I felt so frozen out of things in the U.S. There was no possibility to access anybody to you know, I would never be meeting with the Treasury Secretary or something right. like that. But in Sweden, they were, and I respect that so much, that they would have a meeting and talk about this. And
right.
they listened to what I said, and they did not disagree. You know, they were kind of somber about it. And when I pushed them about it, they said, well, if the Germans will stand up against this, maybe. So the implicit attitude was little Sweden can't do anything about this. We're just going right. to be smaller. And that's what was coming. So then that was maybe in 2011 or 2012. And so the major subversion in Europe was with the Central Securities Depository Regulation, which was implemented in 2014. I think maybe the summer of 2014. So there had been time to get to people and make them aware, years, which so I tried that. And then I actually went to the extent of starting a hedge fund in Sweden. And it allowed me to enter into things and to work with SEB and to understand how the collateral would be handled within SEB, and it actually worked at that point. You could have a separate collateral account that would be safe even if SEB failed. That is no longer the case. So
now, but, how are you sure that that is no longer the case?
Well, I am sure from the CSDR regulation. I agree with you. I have not gone back into SEB again. See, when I did this, I was able to work with people at high levels there and actually to get it in writing. But I know what has changed since. So, for example, when I was doing that, I could still have my securities at Handelsbank in a separate account. That was subverted very clearly because the Handelsbank closed those accounts. they wound them down and closed them. This is something that had existed forever. And now you were, your only alternative was to hold things in a custody account, which is at Euroclear.
Could I back up for a second? I worked in a back office, and this was way back, 70s. And we actually held paper securities, and we had to count them, and they had, you know, names on them. And the things that were in street name, they might be in the name of the brokerage firm. Now, is it even possible to hold? Presumably, there are people who physically never traded a security since the 70s and might still have one. But wow. I mean, is it even possible to get a certificate? And
yes, it is true. Sweden, for example, has gone all the way to the extent that it is literally illegal for public companies to issue paper securities. So they've gone all the way to the dream, you know, and gotten the pat on the head for doing this just perfectly. There are still, it is still possible to get paper certificates in the US and Canada and Britain. It is possible. And but here's the problem. The problem is that all public companies have been pushed with, I say those the gods would destroy, they first encouraged to borrow cheaply. All public companies have been led to borrow massively at low interest rates and thinking that they're so smart locking things in at these low rates. So, you know, I've tried this. If you look for public companies that you think could be bulletproof in a depression, they're all heavily indebted. Now, what does that mean? As in the Great Depression, most public companies were wiped, the equity layer was wiped out. That's what's coming. So equity will not be the place to be. If you go back and you look at the Depression, all of the dynamic ends up being in the senior secured debt. Everything below that is wiped out. So
there were lots of equities that weren't wiped out during the Depression that traded through.
Well, during the dot-com bubble, I went down and I went through the chart books, and I would say the majority of public companies ceased to exist. The majority of public companies went bankrupt. That's not to say that some right. not continue, but that's how you get a decimation of the index. I mean, the same thing happened.
Right.
In the dot-com.
Right. But remember, in the dot-com bubble, you purposely created thousands of companies that had no economic rationale behind them.
Yes.
And then they go down. But yes. There's still lots of boring, profitable companies running along, although under amazing headwinds, given what the central banks are doing.
The problem is, you know, when I went down and went through these chart books, I went through all the equities, I went through all the commodities, and what you see is that all commodities bottomed at a hard price low of the prior 60 years. What that means, I mean, it's a profound
right.
collapse in price level. So that anything that is indebted, that has a debt level.
Right. Right.
It might not be immediately taken, but it becomes very difficult to service those.
Okay.
Debts.
So let's get to it, because debt is, you know, you make some great points about debt in the book, and I want to get there, but let's go back because I want to finish custodian and then go to debt. So for the people who are not familiar with securities, what we're talking about is if you own a stock that is at a brokerage firm, can the creditor of the brokerage firm grab that stock? In other words, do you own the stock or does the brokerage firm own the stock, or can the creditor grab it from the brokerage firm? But then you go to a higher level if that stock is held in street name. So the brokerage firm turns around and keeps it in street name at DTC, which is the U.S. depository, or Euroclear in Europe. Can a creditor at the DTC level grab it, right? And and there are two concerns. One is the rules and regulations that have applied, which have changed ownership into something called beneficial ownership. But the other is we continually see workouts, resolutions, and bank runs where nobody follows the rules anyway, and they just do stuff that's not legal, right? So part of it is they've changed the rules, but part of it is they feel free to break the rules.
Well, I see this working like greased lightning. I think it is. This is all wired, so it doesn't require chaos. There may be an overlay of chaos and panic created for the public, but they know precisely what they're doing. So the key thing is that, you know, the first step was that these things, the dematerialization, but you could have dematerialization and still have specific identification. You could know who owns what. The next step was this creation of the entitlement, securities entitlement. That is the linchpin. That's now what that did is it takes something that had been property and it turns it into a contractual claim. That's all we have now. A contractual claim to your security, always and everywhere. It's only a contractual claim now.
So let me, because I can't. The one thing is I can't follow. I'm not saying that the logic isn't there, but I can't follow it. So let's say the day comes when, you know, the international custodian or street name depositories. Creditor, the few banks grab all the securities that they can through this system, and they have to walk into court and give the legal basis upon what they did, why they had the legal right to do that. What I don't understand is the legal construction that supports that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really laid out in that Fed response to the legal certainty group. And that's why I have excerpts in there, but then I have included the response in its entirety in the appendix because it's so
right
historically.
Just because the Fed says something doesn't mean it's true.
Well, what they are pointing to is. What they are pointing to quite explicitly and heavily is the operation of Article 8 and 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. So that is the law that they are pointing to. This is the key thing in the U.S. It was done in state law.
And what happens if a state rescinds it?
Well, that's what we should be talking about. That's what needs to be done. The way to unwind this is to go back to how it was done and to reverse what was done.
So, and that would have to happen in New York, right?
Well, it would happen state by state. Any state, this is what we need is, and we're kind of jumping ahead here too. So What we need is really it was done on the state level in the U.S. This is the beauty of the federal system in the U.S. There is the potential for people in any state to reverse the changes made to the UCC and to say this would be illegal. So let me go through the construct again.
Okay.
To show how, and as I say, you could explain this to a classroom of 12-year-olds. And they would say, well, that's not right. Just don't do that. As you're saying, this couldn't be legal. But this is how gross the illegality is. So what they've done is they've taken something. Well, first of all, I'll say, you know, in bankruptcy, a contractual claim is very, very weak. You're lining up with all the unsecured creditors. So we had this situation where securities were property. They were not a contractual claim, whereas derivative instruments, which are just contracts, that's all they are. They're contracts. They had no secured interest. They did not have super priority. What they've done is a very sophisticated sleight of hand to turn what were hard property interests into a contractual claim and to give super priority to what would never have had a priority interest, the contracts, especially in bankruptcy.
So you're saying in the bank, so let's take it at the brokerage level. If a brokerage firm has derivatives, not in your account, but in general, a creditor, it goes into bankruptcy, you're saying the derivatives can claim.
Well, I think I would not look at it at the individual broker level because all this is transmitted up to.
So let's talk the DTC level or the international.
Yeah, you really have to look at the whole enchilada because that's how the whole thing works.
Okay, so let's look at the DTC level. Now, DTC is not going to have derivatives outstanding.
No, but they, this is the food chain. You have, and again, in the book, I would point to this. So the Fed response is very important in explaining this. And it's irrefutable because it's directly from attorneys at the Fed.
But that's their opinion. And so we know if the New York Fed has an opinion, the New York courts are probably going to follow it. But that doesn't make it law. In other words, there has to be.
This is a separate issue. The only reason it's absolutely why we should be doing this and talking about it and exposing it is it has to be challenged legally. And that's a huge topic. It absolutely can be done. It must be done because it's everything they're doing here should be illegal.
But to challenge it legally, you need to know what they think their basis is in terms of legal jurisdiction.
That's what I'm saying. In the US, it is Article 8 and 9. They're clear.
Is it also the bankruptcy code?
Then it was the creation of the expansion of Safe Harbor, which is Safe Harbor in 2005. So there's a timeline. You know, the amendments to the UCC were in 1994. It probably took about 10 years to get all the states to enact this. And then, so now you're at 2004, 2005, they enact the Safe Harbor, changes to Safe Harbor. And just briefly, I'll explain, that sounds like a nice thing, Safe Harbor, but it means Safe Harbor for the secured creditors to take the client assets in situations that just prior to that and throughout history would have been constructively fraudulent.
But David, let me hold up for a second. To me, it's the client asset taking. There are cases where that doesn't happen, and there are cases where it does, apparently, the brokerage firm that Barron's referred to. But if you look at the Lehman case, the retail accounts got transferred and weren't touched by the creditors.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. People are conflating things there. This is the way I would explain this. The real action that happened with Lehman was with institutional accounts.
Funded.
People look at it and they say, well, the retail accounts were fine. So what are you talking about? Now, this answer to that, what is absolutely true is the moment the Lehman bankruptcy was filed, all accounts, including all the retail accounts, were frozen. They were encumbered in the bankruptcy. That is something that would not have happened some years before. You know, before the implementation of this revision of the UCC. So I've said to people, look, imagine this, you're in the middle of a horrible financial collapse and your account you can't access your account precisely when you need to be able to do things. That is what happened. They then basically sold the retail business. So it was a situation where they could keep that intact. It was an economic decision for them to sell, merge out the retail business. But the institutional clients, their assets, their collateral that they had been depending on to be their collateral buffer, their collateral was taken. When they right. were not using that collateral, Lehman was using their collateral, their client collateral. So that was definitely should have been illegal. It would have been constructively fraudulent before the changes to Safe Harbor. And that's why that decision, I cite in the book, is so monumental. So people that say, but yes.
What exactly is that collateral? You say the collateral of the institution. Well,
in that case, it would have been government bonds. You know, at that point, what was being used was.
But they owned outright.
That these institutions, they were mainly hedge funds. It was their government bonds were being used by Lehman to underpin Lehman's proprietary trading. And then JP Morgan, which was both the custodian for the client accounts, which was the custodian for the client accounts, took the customer collateral. So here you have a custodian that is acting to seize the customer collateral. Now, these are different subsidiaries of JP Morgan right. doing this. It was done, prior, it used to be that the trustee had a duty to claw back assets that were taken out of the bankruptcy estate on the eve of the bankruptcy. And so here you have the custodian taking the client assets on the eve of the bankruptcy. And also, this is the other thing that the 12-year-olds would recognize as wrong. The customer collateral is taken free of payment, literally free of payment. So this was another thing is for something being constructively fraudulent, if something is taken for less than substantially equivalent value, that's fraud. So
David, did the institutional investors give Lehman permission to rehypothecate collateral?
Well, I don't know that, but I know from the Fed response that does not matter because the key is, you know, beyond the entitlement, the creation of the entitlement, making this a contractual claim, all securities are pooled. There's no way to get out of that. They are all pooled. So even and the Fed response mentions this twice. It's very explicit that even if you're told that your securities are segregated, they're still in the same pool, and you receive only a pro rata share of what's left in the pool. So yes, an institutional client could say, I do not want my securities loaned out. The custodian can say, all right, we will not loan your securities out. You may have to pay a higher fee for custody because we're not using yours. But in this subterfuge, they're in an undifferentiated pool where the objective is to use all of the securities in the pool. So everyone can be told what they want to hear.
Right.
But no actual firewall on those assets.
So I'm just leaping ahead. My understanding in MF Global is the retail accounts were compromised. Now, I have not researched that. But it looks to me, at least in the U.S., at the brokerage level, it's murky. Because in some cases they have been, in some cases they haven't been. And it's not clear to me, as a legal matter, why some are left untouched and some are touched. I still think it's murky.
I think it's just that it was not comprehensive at that time. I think it's important to understand the principles that have been demonstrated, and to understand that just because they were not fully utilized, given a circumstance, for example, Lehman, what followed the Lehman bankruptcy? Well, an even bigger bubble was blown. So there was some possibility of recovery. And in fact, ultimately, I mean, it took 5 years for instance just to begin getting some of the institutional money back. The whole thing took 13 years to resolve. But all, you know, they claim, well, everybody was made whole. And as I say to people, look, imagine that your car is stolen when you need it. And after weeks or months or maybe years, a car kind of like your car is given back to you. Does that mean your car wasn't stolen?
Right.
Right. And it has depreciated or changed in value.
So you didn't have the use of it. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about losing use and control of your assets when you most need to have access to them. And the, in those cases, there was a bigger bubble that was blown. So, you know, we have to think about the context of these past episodes, even something like the collapse of the Nikkei and the Japanese economy. You know, that was occurring against the backdrop of a major boom that was happening everywhere else in the world, whereas this is a global synchronous collapse we're looking at. It will be quite different than these past episodes. So I agree with what you're saying, Catherine, that these situations are they can be confusing because they're all different in terms of how they played out and what the broader context was. And
well, the rules aren't clear from what's been happening. In other words, there's no clear set of rules that are being followed the same way every time. It's what it looks like to me. And I think, you know, part of the problem here is I think it's like everything else in the financial system. It's intentionally obscured.
Oh, you can count on that. but that's why what I try to do is to see to look through that complexity to see the simple pieces of this and explain it clearly. So I think there are primary source documents. So it's not a matter of going through, you know, a lot of different court documents and news articles and things like that. I go to what the architects are saying themselves. So that's why this Fed document is so illuminating, because the EU Legal Certainty Group, which again is about providing legal certainty to the secured creditors. Let me turn this slide on. The secured creditors to take the customer assets. So the EU is undertaking the mandate to conform to the US model. So we have a lot of exposure, both from the Fed side and from the EU process and discussion of exactly what they are doing and why they are doing it, what the objectives are, how the plumbing works. So it's not conjecture.
So let me bring up a couple of points, and then I want to talk about banks for a second. I believe that they are putting into place many different mechanisms to compromise property rights and essentially wipe them out. But the ultimate one is a combination of digital IDs and CBDCs. in a way that can deny access to bank account, internet, and energy, and control access to internet, energy, you know, et cetera. And to me, that's the, you know, if there's a nuclear bomb in the mix, that's it. So if you look at what they've been doing with securities, it looks to me a lot of what they did and when they did it was to try and keep the collateral fraud going. In other words, they wanted to be able to prove they had complete control in the worst case of the collateral. I don't think they wanted to tank the game, because I don't think they can tank the game until they've got a CBDC and digital ID system globally.
We're very close to that, given the number of governments that are, or central banks, not governments, central banks that are working on CBDC. I agree with you that that is where it is going. But it will be brought about, the imperative for people to use that will be brought about by a collapse and an environment of panic where they don't have access to any of their resources, so they have no alternative. That's why we have to explain this beforehand. So right. All the way to the top of the system, so people can say, hey, I don't want to go here. This is not something I'm happy about.
Okay, so one of the things I really enjoyed about your book was you did something that I ended up doing, which is going back and looking at my family history and realizing how my family had gotten played again and again and again in these cycles. Yes. And you do a very good job of weaving in sort of your personal journey and your family's personal journey with surviving these different cycles and what they do. And you start to see the cost of having, you know, I call it a parasite sometimes, of having the sort of central bank parasite. But one of the things you describe is, and you do a great job of doing it, what it's like when the central bank basically implodes a portion of the banking system and the people who have assets at those banks lose the assets. But of course, the debt transfers to new banks. And so your debt is outstanding and your asset. So the debt is respected and your asset is not.
Yes.
And the result, of course, is many foreclosures of home and other devastation. And that is an old game that has been going on, I believe, for centuries. And that is something we saw happen, I'm assuming, in SVB. I haven't followed up to see if the, you know, the debt's transferred, but I'm assuming they did. This is something you do a very good job of warning about. So I'd love you to just cover it for a second.
Oh, well, I do believe in the value of living memory, and it's one of the few ways we can really know anything is through our own experiences and really, really thinking about what we know from our own experiences and what we can know from other people, living memory. And then you can extend that into, you know, source documents, letters, diaries. So, you know, I'll just tell you, I have this place in Canada, and I had a little house built that just to store all this stuff. I probably have 25 boxes of photographs and business papers and all of these things. And, you know, I really was always interested in listening to what I could learn from my, you know, my grandparents and my parents and aunts and uncles. And but I've been able to dig into this and confirm some things in terms of what happened during the Depression and what happened with the collapse in price levels. I think the other part of this was I was essentially raised by my grandmother. I mean, my parents were there, but it's this situation where the old and young have time for each other. So my grandmother had been, she was a nurse. My grandfather was a surgeon. They had been in the first medical unit into World War I in France. And I know from going through things, the scale of what they were dealing with. So they were in a facility that had 3,000 beds. That sounds big, but they had more casualties than that every day. It was absolutely overwhelming carnage. And I think I picked up something from my grandmother at an early age about, she didn't make me fearful because I'm not a fearful person, but I know that things can go badly.
I think that's called awe.
Sorry,
it's called what?
I think that's called awe. You were in awe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I.
But you got a healing impulse from your grandmother.
Yeah. Well,
in other words, they couldn't talk you into being a doctor, but they did talk you into being a healer.
Yeah, I knew from her that it wasn't about making money. It had things there was a much bigger purpose in life than that. And so I think I got that from her. So that's what I try to convey is that I went into understanding all of this because I saw the great harm that was occurring in Cleveland, the impact on my family, and I can't ignore that. So that became the journey of my life, really.
Right.
Isn't a lot of this coming out of the Glass-Steagall and the regulatory mechanism by which these banks get so big that they are able to do something like breaking the law? I mean, as I understand it, it would have been illegal for laymen to pledge retail accounts for its own loans. I mean, if you have smaller banks that are not doing their own taking risk with their own capital and mixing that with the customers, you don't have anywhere near the exposure of the customers.
I think we're conflating things here because it really isn't Lehman that Lehman is using the retail accounts directly. You know, this is the subterfuge. In the books and records of the custodian, the broker, it looks like everything is fine and dandy. They can even maintain this illusion that these accounts are segregated. They're not being commingled with the assets of the debtor of the firm that might fail. So that illusion is maintained at the level of the broker, the custodian. The problem is at the higher level where the assets are pooled, and they always are. There's no alternative to pooling. So the record keeping is a separate thing. That's what helps to maintain the illusion. And that's the case in Europe, where the central securities depository at the national level looks like it always has. We know who owns what, and that is very important to keep a hold of. We absolutely can know who owns this property. The subterfuge then happens at the pooled level. In Europe, the assets go up to the International Central Securities Depository. In the U.S., it's at DTC. And if you the whole drive of the system is to use those those pools without restriction as collateral underpinning the derivatives complex. So let's go back to that. We kind of lost,
right?
Got off that, but the other thing beyond this response from the Fed to the Legal Certainty Group, another very important document in there is this piece from the Bank for International Settlements that is explaining the mobility of collateral and the use right. of cross-border. And I've put one chart in there. There are many in the document, but this one in particular, it shows at the top equity trading desks, different types of custodians, and that level, it's important to note that it includes equities. That level is labeled the collateral givers. And then there's a flow going to the collateral management system, that automates this. And then at the bottom of the chart, so they're showing the flow going down. At the bottom of the chart are the central clearing counterparties. Now, these are the collateral takers. So collateral giver, collateral taker. Now, this is what allows there to be an illusion that there is collateral backing under a derivatives complex that is over a quadrillion. Some are now saying it's twice that, 2 quadrillion. So it's from using the collateral in these pools without restriction. They also talk about the long established doctrine of self-help. And this collateral is used free of payment, FOP.
So what you're saying is if the central clearinghouse, we'll use the international one, has $100 billion of assets that are being held in street name for various brokerage firms and banks, that if it's settling trades in a derivatives market, it can use that $100 billion to either provide collateral for the derivatives market or simply take it if it needs the money for the derivatives market. And that's where I don't understand where the legal basis is.
Well, all I can say is it's in all these documents from both sides, but the exposition of this, both from the EU side.
Right, but they don't give a legal basis. In other words,
It is positive law. It's a posit. It's just saying this is what we're doing. It should be theft. It should be theft because you're taking someone else's property. It is done without their knowledge or consent. You know, I can see the trail of this in the subversion of the Swedish law.
So let me ask you something, David. We've been seeing all sorts of funny business in the financial system as a result of the BIS or various institutions having sovereign immunity. Does that have anything to do with what may give them the power to do this?
You know, I think this is an aside. My wife and I have this joke that we all kind of a meme between us in applying to these situations. There is a situation with a raccoon and a box of peaches that it had knocked over on the floor. And the raccoon was just fixing my daughter in the eye and taking one peach after the next, just fixed her in the eye and was pulling the peaches over. And that's what these people are doing. They are just picking up the peaches. They are just staring us down. These things are all remarkably simple constructs that are.
So you're saying they're just saying we're going to do it. We don't need law.
Well, they're doing it in through structures. They are, of course, in the EU. The CSDR regulation is a regulation that was enacted by the EU and adopted by all the states. It's just,
so I'll give you a perfect example. So FASB 56 in the U.S. is an administrative policy that makes the claim as a matter of administrative policy that it supersedes the Constitution, the financial management laws, and the regulations. So it's an inversion, which can't possibly be legal, but they're doing it anyway.
Yes. Well, that's what we're facing. You know, in the U.S., you know, as I said, it was done in state law. So it has to be addressed again in looking at these changes that were made.
Is there an attorney who's put forward the specifics of what a state legislature would need to do to reverse it?
I would say no. This is the beginning of this. I've taken to saying lately, I think the problem is that attorneys, I don't want to offend anyone here, but attorneys tend to focus in on the details, and they don't really see the big picture, especially something as big as this. So they're mired in the details. So one has to see the strategy.
Well, except for this, you're looking at the practice and what they're saying they're going to do, including inversions like FASB 56. I'm still trying to come up with the legal pathway, and maybe they don't need one. But I'm used to having a concrete sequential, and part of it is the uniform. The UCC is impossible for someone like me to understand. I mean, it's one of the most Byzantine jigsaw puzzles there exists on the whole planet.
Probably by design.
Well, what I would love to do is find a UCC attorney expert who could figure out how to reverse this. What's the package a state legislature needs to reverse it? Because that's something that can be done that would be very positive.
I believe what has to happen is we have to have attorneys, prosecutors, and judges that become personally outraged about this. They have to personally care about this.
Well, but what about an attorney general?
Well, also.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me they need to be hiring UCC attorneys away from. The problem is most of the UCC attorneys, certainly Article 8, would be working for the enemy, basically.
Well, yeah.
Right.
They'd be working for, the brightest minds of how to do these, what we think of as illegal things are. I mean, I went to school with Barry Zubrow, who was the chief rest guy and who was the guy who was quoted about the repos in the Lehman transaction, in the bankruptcy. And, you know, there aren't people like that who are trying to take down the system that allows those clients to do what they're doing.
Absolutely. They will be conflicted. Their firms will already be conflicted so that they can't work on this. So it requires someone else to take.
We'll get one that's been fired and booted out.
The other thing that I can't quite get is there are legal opinions out there. I've been with law firms that give legal opinions in connection with large transactions, and they're looking at every detail and every risk because they're putting their firm and all their partners on the line when they do a legal opinion that says this transaction holds together. And it sounds to me as if there are many transactions in that bankruptcy context where their opinion would not save anybody because the courts would go and would be using the rationale that you're talking about.
So let me jump in because David's been very generous with his time, and I promised him we wouldn't go over an hour, and we're about to go over an hour.
And a little bit.
So state legislatures taking action is one thing that can happen in the U.S., but another thing that can happen is people can be very, very careful about debt and who they do debt with and how they do debt. And I think it's fair to say throughout the book, you theme different ways debt can bite you. And you've got to understand you're you know, when you do debt in this economy, you're doing debt in a war zone. It's not a market economy.
Yeah. It's, yeah, I did not, people get frustrated with the book because they say, well, you didn't tell me what to do to protect myself. And I have to say, it's not an investment advice book. It's about something bigger than that. And this right. this is what it has come to. So, but of course, getting out of debt is just, but I've even circled back on that because I will say to people, look, don't do anything that will destroy your marriage, you know, the lives of your children, you know, your happiness. We're all going to get through this somehow. There are a lot of people that are in debt, and I don't want to push someone to think they have to sell their house if they're going to end up divorced and their kids are going to hate them. You know, it's but if you can do things that will give you more peace and security, by all means, do those things. So I know people that have sold their homes and are renting, or they sell their home and they buy something in a more rural area. You know, you, Catherine, have talked about having a greenhouse. I have a greenhouse. You know, right. Those are good things to invest in. But now we get to the big thing. I've, since writing the book, I've been contacted with by people globally that are, you know, some are billionaires, some are, you know, they're people that manage huge amounts of money. And I've tried to suggest to them that, so this is the first step. When you realize that this is real, the first instinct is, how can I run? How can I hide? How can I protect myself? My big message is,
you can't.
Ultimately, you can't, just as you said. And that is like the next step that people have to get to. And that means that we have to face up to this.
Yes. One of the things I find shocking about the reaction to your book,
yeah,
is people who should have known for the last 20 years that this was all working up to a destruction. You know, the World Economic Forum has made it very clear, as you make clear in your book, you know, it's 2030, you have no assets.
Yeah.
I mean, why was that message not getting through before? And now it's getting through and people are realizing, oh, the problem is we have a governance system. We have a group of people who can print as much money as they want and are above the law. And you can never operate successfully with that formula. It will never work. So it's got to be dealt with. And there's no running away from it.
Yes. We're heading toward totalitarianism, global totalitarianism. Right. And it's so I had one friend who read this early on and sent me an email. And he was saying, of course, everybody needs to know about this. His family is very wealthy, and his last line was, "What can we do to protect our investments? Probably nothing. We just have to stop them." Now, this is someone who very wealthy, mainstream American. Right. The Harvard Business School, or Harvard and Harvard Law, and
he just needs to stop the Harvard Endowment.
That's right. So,
and the Harvard Corporation. Who does he think this is?
So, you know, so this is happening. People like this are starting to realize this is where we are. But then the next level is what to do about it. And I believe this has to be addressed peacefully and legally. And that, as you've been pointing to, Catherine, what has been done is really so incredibly ham-handed. I mean, there's an intelligent construct behind it, but it's insane. it just because it seems to be clever, it doesn't mean it's
well.
Smart.
But there's enough clear criminality that we have all the grounds we need if we decide to exercise. You know, if you take the powers that the states have, plus you take the criminality that's occurred, there is more than enough grounds on a legal basis to win this.
Yes. Well, so it has to be challenged legally. But the thing that I'm trying to do is to, I mean, it's very easy to get angry and to see this as a fight, and it is. But I think it's been helpful for me to think of this in terms of a big tent. We're all in it, including even the people that have aided and abetted this.
Yep.
That we could argue about what consciousness is, but we know we have a whole lot of unconsciousness, you know, the unconsciousness all the way to the top. So we are headed towards something without people being fully conscious of what's about to happen.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So even the people at the top of this, if they pull this down, they will be destroyed by their own hand if they do this. It can't possibly go well for them ultimately.
Right. But I do think a lot of the impulse for doing it was to protect the collateral markets. In other words, I don't think they were building up to a great taking so much as trying to build up to keep the collateral game going. And they can't keep it going forever, which is why they're coming up with 20 ways of doing a taking.
I think I used to believe what you're saying there, but now when I go back and I've done a lot of work on this and reflection on this, when I look at what was done in the 30s and how deliberate this has been to this, it's exactly the same playbook they're using again. And
yeah, so they keep taking and taking and taking and taking.
It is not doing it for us.
Oh, absolutely. But I think the reason they were trying to keep the collateral market going was so they could keep taking. In other words, they were taking so much out the back end.
Yeah. And it's ultimately a belief. There's someone that got in touch with me through this. He said that it's a kind of logic that people cannot be allowed to determine their own reality, that someone has to do it for them. And if we don't do it, someone else will. So we are going to do it. And this is the same kind of attitude that was underlying communism and National Socialism. It's always there. This idea that the individual cannot be allowed to determine things. So what it denies is that the world is so vastly complex that central planning does not work. That autonomy is really, while it is not controllable, it is much more efficient. Autonomy and self-determination.
Well,
so it's a fallacy that we have to control everything. So they will control things to the detriment of everyone else, because it's actually not about bettering things for people.
I've just finished doing an interview with Whitney Webb on AI, and I've been reading a couple books on AI, including one that goes through the environmental damage of the hardware necessary to run a global AI system. You know, so it's the whole energy and telecommunications and IT infrastructure, the environmental expense and damage. I mean, I knew it was uneconomic. I had no idea how uneconomic it was. And if you look at it's an extraction model where ultimately you have to depopulate because it's so uneconomic. So, you know, control is the most economically wasteful thing I've ever seen in terms of what it's doing. And if you look at where it's going, I think, you know, I think they not only have to take a lot of assets, they have to take a lot of lives to keep it going.
Yeah, it's yeah, we this is the imperative. We are in open-ended hybrid war.
Right.
It'll never end. And that's why, you know, now we have to face up to it. It's becoming apparent enough. So now this is the hope for us all, oddly enough, by injuring everyone globally, all the way to the top of the system, and at the same time, divide and rule breaks down. For the first time in human history, it's always worked if you could injure a set of people over here, but these other people are living under the illusion that it's being done for their benefit.
Right.
In this case, by injuring people all the way to the top of the system, this is what creates the turning point. And we can see it's been done before. I mean, look at the Russian Revolution. Ultimately, the wealthy will not be protected. In fact, that is the kind of last divide and rule exploitation, is that the people in the middle, former middle class, that have been destroyed, and all the people at the bottom that already knew all this, they will have no sympathy at all for the wealthy that are being taken apart in the last phase of this. It will be, that's why we need people at the top of the system to understand this. The way I think of it, there's a head of the snake. The head of the snake doesn't do anything. It is totally reliant on a support layer beneath it to do everything. So if this awareness is pulled out, laid out on the table, everybody can see it. We can all look at it and say, really, this is a really bad idea, incredibly stupid, really. And the people at the top of the system in this support layer can realize, I don't want this. I'm not going to be protected through this. I know I've been paid a lot of money, but I'm more concerned about not losing everything I have. Then they can begin withdrawing their support from this. It can start to fade. They're also maybe one degree of separation from the people at the very top of this, who probably aren't. The other thing I've been saying, these people have inherited this. They didn't design this.
Right.
They're trapped in it also. So we need people that can help them to dismantle it.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, I think you've done a great service by helping people understand that there is no way, and we have to deal with the root problem. So, and that includes the very wealthy.
Yes.
This is something that can take down anybody, and there's no workaround. It's one of the reasons I gave up being an investment advisor, because everybody wanted me to give them a workaround, and I kept telling them there is none. There's no law. Well, there's no workaround.
Well, there is in a sense a workaround in the sense that if you do everything locally and what you own is within your community, however big you want to make that locality, you're not exposed to all the rest of it.
You know, I beg to differ. I've read the WHO amendments. The WHO can find there's a virus in your septic tank and we're coming and taking control, putting you all under quarantine. And here you go.
You have to have a governance structure that recognizes that, however.
Exactly. But if you look at all the mechanisms they're putting into place to intercede and take, you know, this comes down to you have to stop them.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. You have to stop them. And the little secret is that tyranny is so wasteful and expensive. In fact, if you can stop them and start to rebuild bottom up, there's plenty of wealth. There's no economic problem here other than the parasite.
Absolutely. I second that strongly. I think the reality is everything gets better immediately
right.
if you just stop. So principles, give people back their own stuff. you have all the records of who owns what. People get their own stuff back. Number two, stop hurting people.
It's amazing what could happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let markets work. Okay. Yeah. David Webb, you've been very generous with your time. Carolyn, before we finalize, anything else you wanted to add?
No, it's just, it definitely turns on its head everything that one would learn in law school.
Aren't you glad we got booted out of Washington in 1998? Or really, yeah, 96. We got booted out. Right after they changed the UCC, we got booted out. And don't think that mortgage, you know, because the collateral fraud in the mortgage market was unbelievable. Sometime I should tell you all the stories. It's just...
Well, actually, now that you say that, the UCC amendments were just a couple years before all of that happened to us in Washington.
Yeah, but there are two things, because you can see the timeline and the UCC stuff. And one of the reasons I know the UCC is deep in this is because of where it fits on the timeline. But the UCC changes got made, and then the New York Fed and the Fed bought stock in the BIS and went all in on the BIS system. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, same thing. All the people who were running the mortgage fraud clean got booted out of Washington. Boom, boom, boom. Anyway, Carolyn and I are big fans of chronologies, because the chronologies show you how planned out all these things are.
Yes.
Anyway. Okay. David, have a wonderful snowstorm in Sweden. Thank you very much for joining us on the Salida Report.
Thank you so much. We're in cahoots.
If there's anything we can do to help with your effort to educate and support and turn the wealthy, you know, all we need is the Mandarin class to do a 180. And
yeah.
It's remarkable what could happen.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Catherine and Carolyn, thank you so much. This was a really good discussion. Thank you.
It was fun. It was fun. We should do more.
We will.
Yes.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.